Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Friday, October 11th at 6 p.m. at PSU Smith Center. Vitale directs the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project. He wrote The End of Policing. He demonstrates that the great expansion of police authority has come to exacerbate the very problems they're supposed to solve. He discusses how to counter the warrior mentality and police reliance on force and weaponry, and describes actually operating successful alternatives. But he insists that no reform will substantially succeed unless this country deals with deeply entrenched inequalities and injustice. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Friday, October 11th at 6 p.m. at PSU Smith Center, 1825 Southwest Broadway. Imagine a world beyond policing. That's no impossible dream. More information can be found on KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor in Evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Senior Center in Portland. Ken Stringfellow, founding member of the Posies, performs songs from his 30-year career as a musician. This night features songs and stories from his work as a solo artist, as well as Neil Young, Big Star, Robin Hitchcock, and much more. Again, that's an evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 at the Hollywood Senior Center, 1820 Northeast 40th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's so unbridled with the hope that someone's reading.
Welcome to The Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yemen. And today I am going to be joined on the phone by Annalee Newitz. Annalee writes fiction and nonfiction about the intersection of science, technology, and culture. They are contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, previously the founding editor of IO9, and has served as the editor-in-chief of Gizmodo and as the tech culture editor at Ars Technica. In addition, has worked as a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and has a PhD in English and American Studies from UC Berkeley. Her most recent book, The Future of Another Timeline, is a story about time travel. And where are we here? Annalee, welcome to The Digital Divide.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And by the way, you are going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Clackamas tonight. Is that at 7 p.m.?
That's right, 7 p.m. And I'll be reading from the book and talking a little bit about it.
That's at 12-12000 Southeast 82nd Avenue in Portland, Oregon. We'll give you that information again at the end of the program. So, Annalee, how are you? How's your book tour going?
It's good. Actually, tonight will be the last stop on a 3-week tour, so I'm going to try to do something special.
I wonder what that could be.
Might involve a little yelling.
Okay, well, you know, yelling, that's cathartic, especially these
it
days.
Is, yeah.
So in the future of Another Timeline, readers meet Tess, brought up in Orange County, California. I hail from Southern California. So in reading some of these descriptions, they're a little nostalgic for me in a weird, creepy way. And the book is about time travel. So the first thing is it feels really complicated to talk about your book without giving everything away.
It's true. There are a couple spoilers, but it's there's definitely stuff we can talk about without, you know, totally giving away some of the twists. And you know, part of the book is really not just about the fun of time travel, which of course is a really neat science fiction trope, but also it's about changing history and how we change history when it feels like the odds are stacked against us.
Well, that's right. In your book, when you first mention the Daughters of Harriet, you write, even when it seemed like we made significant progress in the past, the present remained stubbornly unchanged. And I had to just stop right there for a minute. I had to take a minute and say, that doesn't feel like science fiction. That feels real and present.
Yeah, I think a lot of science fiction is about the present. You know, there used to be this idea that in science fiction we predicted the future of technology and, you know, that we were looking into kind of a crystal ball. But the fact is that time travel will never exist. So this is not a future technology. And what I really wanted to think about was, as I say in that section of the book, that it's very hard to change the present. It feels like if you're, you know, in a social movement or part of an organization that's trying to make things better or change things, progress is so slow. And so I wanted to bring in a time machine because I wanted my characters who are feminists, who are trying to make history better for women, I wanted them to be able to go back in time and see progress happening on a much bigger scale across generations, because as normal people, we don't get to see that. You know, we don't get to travel back to the 19th century or to the first century and see how things have changed for women. And so that's what these characters get to do. And part of the fun of this book was tweaking this idea that I think a lot of time travel stories have, which is that you're not supposed to change history. And if you do change it, like, terrible things will happen. And my characters are activists, and they want to change the past because they want the present to be better for women. And what they discover in the process of going back and tinkering around with history is, first of all, it's very hard to change. It's just as hard to change the past as it is to change the present. But they also find out that there's a group of men's rights activists who are working against them throughout time.
You're still fighting the patriarchy across all timelines.
Yes.
So frustrating.
Exactly. It is frustrating, and they keep cropping up. And what they've done in the book, and sort of the focus of the book, is that these guys have gone back to the 19th century and changed things around so that abortion rights have been deleted from the timeline in the United States, and women no longer have reproductive freedom in the way that we kind of have now. And that, as I was writing it, of course, that turned out to be more and more true because I started writing it in 2016 and the longer I was working on it, the more reproductive rights were disappearing for women in the United States.
Right.
And so it started to feel more and more uncomfortably realistic.
Yeah, that one line alone did not feel like fiction to me, you know, because you can see all the progress throughout our, at least American history, in terms of women's rights. And then, but things don't seem that different. You know, we've gone backwards, like you said, in, you know, in the current real nonfiction world. It definitely is a lot of truth into the storytelling. But I would like you to back up that comment that you just made a minute ago, that you said there won't ever be time travel. why will there never, ever be time travel?
I know it's a bummer.
I know. I'm really disappointed to hear you say that.
I know. And so I'm a science journalist by training, and I still do lots of science journalism. So I do like to tell the truth about science. And when I write fiction, I interview scientists and try to make the science in my books as realistic as possible. So when I started out working on this book, I said, great, I don't know very much about physics. That's not really an area I've written a lot about before, but I'm sure that there's got to be a very good way to build a time machine that would be completely realistic based on the physics that we know now. And so I called my friend Sean Carroll, who is a physicist at Caltech, who studies the origins of time and has written a number of amazing books about it. And so I was like, great, I've got you on the phone. Tell me how to do it. How do I make time travel scientifically accurate? And he said, well, you can't. It's just never going to happen. Based on everything we know in physics today, there's no possibility that we could ever move people around in time the way that we do in Doctor Who or Legends of Tomorrow or name your favorite time travel show.
Well, I'm just going to take that as a caveat that based on what we know now.
Sure. And that's one of the things I love about science is that, you know, good scientists will always say, you know, look, based on the evidence we have, you know, this and that can be true or not true. And sure, we could discover something, you know, tomorrow or in a million years that undermines that idea. But I did, you know, I got a second opinion. I talked to another physicist, and he said something that I really loved, which was, this is a physicist named Adam Becker, and he said, look, time travel is not a scientific device. It's a literary device. And that kind of opened things up for me and allowed me to, I mean, I was writing a piece of literature, so I realized that, you know, when you're thinking about history, especially, there is an aspect of it that kind of defies scientific rationality. And maybe we should honor that. You know, maybe we should realize that there's certain aspects of human society that science, you know, science can help us a little bit to understand it, but it isn't completely adequate, and we need other systems of knowledge to deal with it. And so that's kind of what the book is about. It's about women and activists of all stripes trying to figure out ways to change history. And sadly, science isn't going to help them. You know, they've got to figure out other ways. And one of the ways they do it is by making friends and by forming communities, places of resistance to opposition. And, you know, like I said, there's a little science in there, and the book does have a lot of scientists in it, and there's a lot of fun stuff about geology, but really it's about human communities and how they form and how we can remain resilient against setbacks.
What do you think about teletransportation a la Star Trek?
Teleportation?
Yeah.
You know, there's no teleportation in my book.
Right.
There are little bits of evidence that some things can be teleported. But I think, you know, that's another area where it's so far in the future. We can't be sure that you'd ever be able to have something like in Star Trek where you take a person in one area and decompose them and then rebuild them in another place.
I'm hoping.
You might be able to move, like, atomic particles around. You know, what I'm really hoping for is just really good public transit at this point.
I would love
teleportation, but public transit would be miraculous to me.
I have been listening to your podcast, and I did hear you talk about self-driving cars, but after you mentioned them, You were talking about, like, for that last mile, you know, right, to get you from mm-hmm. your public transportation to your actual destination, self-driving cars.
Yeah.
And that it would, you know, like, reduce a lot of accidents. But it doesn't take out, like, the human driver factor that are still driving their car. So I thought, well, if you're going to have self-driving cars, is it all self-driving cars or none? Because, you know, if you have some self-driving cars and then some humans driving cars, you're still going to have accidents, and probably some of those are going to involve humans crashing into self-driving cars. So, you know, I thought, does it have to be all or nothing in order, you know, to reduce
good
accidents?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think probably we will live to see the answer. I think one of the big questions that companies are having to ask about self-driving cars, but even more importantly, governments, local governments and the national government, is how we're gonna transition from one to the other. Because I think at a certain point, we really did have self-driving cars that worked super well, as opposed to the ones we currently have that kind of barely work. There would be a point where, you know, people might be able to assist the car, you know, if they, you know, went out of a service area or there was some breakdown in the network that was controlling the car. But I think you would ultimately want to transition to all self-driving cars. And that doesn't mean that you wouldn't have any crashes. You know, there'd still be bugs in the system. It's never going to be perfect.
Right.
But if you had some sort of network that was actually able to track where all the cars were, it definitely would cut down on the really low-hanging fruit, like mm-hmm. drunk driving. Like, you
right.
just wouldn't have crashes from drunk driving anymore. And that's a huge source of death on the roads. And so, I mean, if you eliminated that, imagine how much better things would be. And you could eliminate distracted driving. People could text in their cars and it would be fine because, you know, they wouldn't actually be driving. So I would love to see that happen. But I think there'll be a weird, messy in-between period where you're right. Like, there's going to be people driving, and then there's going to be computers driving, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
I think there'll be some. Yeah, it'll be an interesting transition. I look forward to it.
I know that you have participated in collectives of various kinds, and in your book, the Daughters of Harriet are a collective, and those are the women that are kind of going around back and forth in time. I was wondering
yeah.
a couple of things. One, just did the name Harriet, where did that come from? Was that just random? But the other thing I really would love for you to talk about is what makes collectives successful, and what are some of the difficulties, and what can be done to turn them around? Because, you know, we see a lot of collectives, especially in progressive communities, and they seem mostly troubled, at least from my perspective. What makes them work and be effective from your perspective?
Good question. So I'll first answer the easy question about why the Daughters of Harriet are called the Daughters of Harriet.
Yeah.
So in my novel, because of the fact that time travel has always existed, it's a mundane part of life. People have been messing around with the timeline forever, as far as we know. And so it's an alternate history. There's some things that are different about the history in this book. And one of the things that's different is that women got the vote in 1870 along with freed slaves. And as a result, the great Civil War hero, Harriet Tubman, has become a senator. And she's the first woman elected official or elected representative. And she becomes she sort of replaces Susan B. Anthony in the public's mind as the face of suffrage and of women's rights. And so she is this huge hero to women and to people of color, and represents a very different kind of feminism than we have today. I think today feminism is still really marred by the fact that there's a big racial divide. There's, you know, white feminism, which tends to ignore questions around you know, women of color and the specific issues that they face. And so in my timeline, things are a little better in that way. And so the Daughters of Harriet have named themselves after the great Senator Harriet Tubman. So that's an easy answer. As for the question about collectives, it is huge. And I've seen, you know, being in progressive politics, but also other kinds of collectives, I have seen a lot of troubled collectives. And I think there's lots of points of failure. And sometimes it has to do with specific personalities, and sometimes it has to do with burnout. You know, I certainly do not have a perfect answer for the question of how do we make a good collective. But from my experience, and also from what I've read about other collectives, it seems like the best structure tends to be temporary structures where leadership is temporary, where groups come together for a temporary need and then are kind of built to dissolve and to rebuild again when there's a new need. I think it's a lot of the problems I've seen come from entrenched leadership problems or entrenched membership problems where there's, you know, layers and layers of rules, or there's tons of baggage and people are arguing over how we used to do things and how should we do things again. So it's easier said than done. Obviously, you know, especially if you're running a nonprofit, for example, and you're depending on, you know, money coming in from your membership, you can't just say like, well, we've dissolved and we're starting a new thing. So that's a tough one. But I do think that even within those kinds of organizations, you can have temporary groups that come into existence to deal with specific problems that are then again are designed to dissolve after a certain point or to be remade differently. And the other thing I think that, you know, the more successful collectives do is we try to be as inclusive as possible while also having gentle but firm rules about how people should behave in the public space of the organization. And I've seen so many organizations fail when they say, all right, we're going to be super inclusive, everyone can come, everyone can participate, and then they also say, and they can participate however they want and talk however they want, and then, you know, people come in who have really different ideas about public behavior. Like they think it's totally fine to be misogynistic or to, you know, make jokes about transgender people. And then women and trans people feel really uncomfortable because they feel like they're being denigrated in those spaces. And so, you know, I think things like having, you know, policies around sexual harassment can be really like a super basic thing that really improves public spaces in a collective. And that's the thing about collectives is they really are about building a public space. And we sometimes forget that and we think, oh, well, because we're progressive, we should just allow anything to happen. You know, we should be inclusive of all kinds of behavior. But in order to build a good public space, you actually do have to limit some kinds of behavior. You have to say, all right, there's certain things you can't say. Feel free to say them in your head. Feel free to say them on Twitter, feel free to say them, you know, in your bathroom, whatever, in your private spaces. But in public spaces where we're trying to come to consensus, you know, there's some things that should just be for inside your head.
Let's kind of, that's, thank you. That was an amazing answer, really. And
oh, thanks.
Very, It definitely mirrors my own observations, you know, volunteering and working with nonprofit organizations, the same. But talking about time travel, so in your book, why is it forbidden to change the timeline? I know that you can make small edits, but it's forbidden to try to change history. And you kind of mentioned that. So, you said bad things will happen. So tell us about those bad things.
Right. So it's complicated because I think a lot of time travel stories, not really my story, there is you know, bad things do happen if you change history. Like if you change one little thing, if you step on a butterfly, then you come back to the, you know, you step on a butterfly several million years ago, then you come back to the present and, you know, there's a fascist dictator who's in charge of the United States. So that isn't true in my book. You don't have things that, you know, tiny little changes making these dramatic shifts. And but what they do have is, you know, my characters who are time travelers are mostly academics. And in academia where they work, you know, there are a lot of regulations and kind of policies. It may not be laws per se, but they're, you know, they're just sort of to operate. And in that context, they're told that they should not change history. They're supposed to observe history.
Oh, you know what, Annalie, you're kind of cutting out. I don't know if you're moving around in the building that you're in, but you're kind of starting to cut out, going from being clear to kind of broken up.
I'm sitting in the same spot, but also you're cutting out too. I'm not sure what happened. Sitting exactly in the same.
Oh, I'm cutting out too. I don't know either. So we don't know which side that's on. I think what we'll do.
Technology is failing us.
Oh yeah, technology. Let's not talk about that. gosh, I have so many questions for you. Science fiction influencing public policy, and what I want to do is I want to. I'd love you to answer that question completely exempting current public politics. So I like if you could just pretend that everything that's happening right now is just temporary and not the way it's always going to be. So going forward into a different world that does not have current policies that we have, how can science fiction influence or help us build better, healthier cultures and societies going forward, solving some of our biggest problems?
Yeah, it's a huge question, and there's a lot of science fiction writers who think about this, and also people who work as futurists who often kind of are in both camps. Like they're science fiction writers, but they're also consulting with governments about what's coming next. And I think fiction can do two things. One that's really basic is it's just a place where our imaginations can run wild and we give ourselves permission to think about different possibilities of where we're going based on what's happening now. So really good futurism based on science fiction or really good policy based on science fiction always acknowledges that there's multiple possibilities. You know, it's not like there's going to be one future. There's many, many ways we could get through a particular problem. And I think that's really useful. As long, you know, when you're looking at fiction and you see how many different visions there are for tomorrow. So I think that's really helpful. And the other thing is that I found, especially as a journalist writing about climate change and climate crisis and the environment and history too, that when you're in the realm of reality, when you're making policies about what's actually happening or you're writing about present day political issues or social issues, people who are reading it feel immediately implicated in what you're saying. They really feel like that they have to respond in some way. It often causes them to kind of tune out because they feel helpless, like there's nothing they can do. And it shuts down your ability to have a discussion, ironically, because there you are talking about what's going on in reality and people just want to kind of run away from it, or they'll say things like, well, that's just the way things are. Humanity's doomed. The planet is doomed. I'm going to go eat lunch. And it kind of leads to this paralysis and nihilism. And I think in fiction, you know, it's the opposite. You can kind of tell the truth about what's happening in the context of a story and invite people in and sort of sit them down and say, like, we're just going to talk about time travel, or here's a story about a robot. And people are like, great, I want to hear about time travel. And then as, you know, you tell the story, you can bring in issues around politics or the environment that are just too hot to touch when it's something that's about our immediate real life, But when it's in a story and we're projecting ourselves into the world of another character or into literally another world, it creates this kind of safe space for us to discuss these ideas and feel like we're not immediately on the hook to do something about them. We can just sort of entertain the ideas. And also, I think in stories, our empathy is a lot more in play. You know, we can empathize with the characters, we can empathize with the situation, and then we take that away from the story with us. And then when we encounter those issues in reality, I think we are still more empathetic and more open to those ideas and talking about them. So I feel like science fiction is kind of it's like the imaginative underbelly of politics, and it has to be there. We have to have that free play of imagination before we kind of go into the realm of like, all right, what are we going to write into law, or like, what's going to be our 10-year plan for like cleaning up this marsh? And because it's just crucial that we have that ability to kind of have an empathetic conversation without consequences.
And not every science fiction book has to end in a dystopian world where people turn into cannibals, and that's just the way it's going to be forever. Yeah. Well, let's have a little musical break, and then we'll come back and we'll keep talking. I am talking with Annalee Newitz, who is going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Clackamas this evening at 7 p.m., talking about and possibly reading from and possibly yelling from her new book, The Future of Another Timeline, a punk feminist sci-fi time-traveling thriller. And we'll be back in just a minute. Listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in Portland. And this is your host, Rabia Yemen. I'm talking with Annalee Newitz. Welcome back. And who are some of the authors that influenced you when you were, you know, just kind of getting your writing chops in terms of fiction? Who influenced you? I know you've mentioned Ursula Le Guin, who we take a lot of pride and ownership in here in Portland.
Yeah, for sure. So especially when I was thinking about time travel, I was really influenced by a lot of feminist science fiction writers who'd also been dealing with time travel questions, like Joanna Russ, who was a fantastic science fiction writer. A lot of her famous work came out sort of starting in the 1970s, and she was a contemporary of Ursula Le Guin, and she wrote an amazing book called The Female Man, which is very experimental and is about three different women who are living in different times that are kind of different timelines, but they're also kind of the same woman. And so we get to see how growing up in a particular time period shapes who you are, and that you aren't just automatically a brave and politically active person no matter what, you know, that if you're born into different circumstances, you might be very meek, for example. And I love that. I loved Margie Piercy's book, Woman on the Edge of Time, which is another feminist classic about a woman who goes into the future and sees two possible outcomes of the present day. One is this horrific kind of police state where everyone is mind controlled by law enforcement officers. And the other possibility is this sort of beautiful environmental world where men and women are equal, and people are actively trying to work to prevent racism, and men take care of babies while women go out and have cool jobs saving the environment. And it's this kind of beautiful glimpse of maybe an impossible utopia, but still kind of soothing. And I also love Octavia Butler and her famous time travel novel, Kindred, which is kind of magical. I mean, there's no scientific parts to it, but it's about a black woman in the 70s who's pulled back in time to rescue her ancestor in order to live, because, you know, if her ancestor dies, she'll die. And it turns out her ancestor is a white plantation owner. And it brings up all these really interesting personal and political questions about, dealing with your own history and figuring out what your relationship is to these horrible things that happened that then brought you into the world and made you possible. So it's a really, all of Octavia Butler's work is terrific in that it brings up these kinds of heavy questions, but also she's just a great storyteller. So those were some of the books that were kind of rattling around in my head when I was working on Future of Another Timeline. And they were also books that really influenced me for a long time. Like, I read as a young adult and really kind of, they kind of sank in and programmed me a little bit.
In your book, they can't go into the future. Why did you decide that wouldn't be possible? Or some people went into or maybe some people went into the future.
Yeah, we don't know for sure, because that's one of the things about the time machines in my book, is that we don't really know where they came from. They weren't like built by some dude in a basement. They're actually, the time machines are built into these rock formations in the earth, and so people have kind of stumbled across them because if you pound on the rocks in a certain way, they open up a wormhole. And there's only five known time machines, so they're planted in one location. You have to kind of get to them and figure them out. And so all that people have figured out so far is how to go into the past, as far as we know. But we do meet a character who suggests that maybe he and his people, he's Cree, he lives up in northern Canada, and he kind of hints that maybe the Cree know how to go into the future, but he won't reveal more than that. And we're never sure if he's just sort of joking or trying to mess with the white people. But he does kind of offer that hint. And so but for me, what I really wanted to do was think about our relationship to history and, you know, how part of present day politics kind of always involves going back into history and looking at what our ancestors have done and reevaluating it, and that every generation reevaluates what has come before, and it is a kind of revision process. You know, we value different types of histories. You know, right now we live at a time when, you know, we're excavating histories that had been kind of forgotten or lost, histories by women, histories by slaves, histories from immigrants that had been kind of shunted to the side. And, you know, having the voices of those people from history in the United States really changes how we understand the country today and kind of makes us, you know, more aware that this was not a country that was built by just people like, you know, George Washington and Franklin, and, you know, that there were slaves who built the country and immigrants. And I mean, that's why a play like Hamilton is so powerful, because it's kind of an editing of history, but it's also just an acknowledgement of an actual history that was going on that has been ignored by history books that were mostly written by white people, and schools that were mostly, you know, founded by white people. And so so that was kind of why I wanted to do that, was to sort of dramatize or literalize what it's like to kind of revisit our history in the present day, just by, you know, looking back and excavating these histories that already exist. And I just think a lot of our problems in the present day go back to not really seeing our history in its complete form.
It has to repeat itself.
Yeah, that's one of the dangers, is that if we don't understand where we've been, we're just going to wind up back there again.
I don't know why that's true, but it certainly seems to be. You know, I want to, it's been such a news-filled week, something came across the news feed that it just seemed to get completely, you know, kind of smothered by all of the other more popular headlines. And that was, there was a blip that came by about net neutrality, and I was like, no, wait, what happened? And I wanted to ask if you had caught that, where are we right now with that? I'm so confused.
Yeah, I mean, it is really confusing, and I don't think we're going to know for sure what's happening for a while. But at a national level, we no longer have net neutrality. But now states like the state of California and some other states are saying, well, we're going to have net neutrality laws in our state. And I'm not sure. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure how that's going to work. I think it's terrific that, you know, a big state like California is standing up for that idea. I mean, I think we do need to have a neutral network that will host every service equally. And, you know, California is a great place to test out that idea, because it is where a lot of the large tech companies and small tech companies are located. But yeah, it really remains to be seen how that's going to shake out. I don't know if that means we're going to end up having a more fragmented network, or if it'll just be impossible to implement. But it's certainly a step in the right direction, I think, for the states that are doing that.
Another kind of topic that's on my mind and my brain is election security. I have to say that without physically freaking out, I am kind of mentally freaking out when I read headlines that say, you know, other countries are buying our, you know, electronic voting machines, and that those companies are owned by foreign companies or corporations or possibly governments. That totally freaks me out. What do you think about electronic voting and it doesn't seem to be secure. I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff about it. You know, people buying voting machines online and them having all the records are in the machine that they bought on eBay, and just it sounds crazy to me.
Things are obviously, especially after the 2016 election, I think we're all much more sensitized to this. But the question around election machine security, you know, that's been around for 20 years. And I was reporting on it back in like the early 2000s, and nothing's really changed other than the fact that now, you know, in the wake of things like the Cambridge Analytica scandal, people are more aware of election meddling. But what's interesting is that what we've seen in terms of potentially throwing an election or at least meddling in an election hasn't been people hacking voting machines.
Right, social
the
media.
The problem has been, the problem has been propaganda and really malicious targeted propaganda and based on kind of harvesting people's user data on social media. And so we obviously need to be working on election security, and there's some pretty simple solutions like having a paper audit trail, which is still the kind of premier solution for that, so that you can actually check against, you know, a piece of paper and see like, okay, this is the vote that I cast, here's the vote that I cast in the machine, here's the paper audit trail, and that you can actually have, a way of checking that against, a potential hostile person messing around with the results in the machine. So that, I think, is actually less of a concern, the idea of these election machines being hacked. More of a concern is making sure that we don't have another situation like we did in 2016, where so much misinformation was circulating, and really nothing is being done about that. There's a lot of talk. Very little has changed at large social networks like Facebook. I think we're likely to see even more countries getting involved in circulating propaganda, and people really be aware that what they see on their Facebook feed or on Twitter, is not necessarily real. It's not necessarily coming from a real person. That's the thing that keeps me up at night. I feel like, a lot of the questions around election machines, are kind of, a bit of smoke to kind of distract us from the real concern.
Well, social media is, it is really easy. And, I remember in the last presidential election, people of all political persuasions, you would share things that if you just did, really, if you just clicked on it and looked at the source, you would see, like, it wasn't any kind of authoritative source whatsoever, or if there was any source. And I think, what I would love to tell, my friends on social media is, just because you see something that reinforces your own passions, don't share it unless you've verified that it comes from a legitimate source. Just because it validates or affirms your opinions. And by the way, the name of your podcast is Our Opinions Are Correct, which I love that title. It's the funniest title. To do like the smallest amount of fact, it's just an extra click, really. Just click on it. And if it's not from a legitimate source, if it's just, some random, .net website, that good chance it's fake or somebody else's opinion or passion, but doesn't make it true or real. And it is a huge concern, and it's that behavior isn't exclusive to any specific political party or individuals. It's seems to be pretty universal. People, want to share what affirms their own beliefs, whether they're real or not.
Yeah, it's really true. And I think that, other countries, and probably the United States too, have figured out ways to weaponize that. And social media is just this perfect test bed for, you know, finding people and kind of reaching them when they're at their most vulnerable, which is, you know, when you're trying to make decisions about who to vote for or what kinds of policies that you want to push for. And so I really hope that as we go into the next election, that people are a little bit more aware of the fact that when you get a piece of news, you know, you can click through to see who gave it to you, and not just the friend who shared it with you, but like who actually read it. And sometimes it's not that hard to figure out if it's from a bot. This happens to me on Twitter all the time, because people will, you know, follow me and start saying weird things, and all you have to do is click over to their profile and you see like, okay, this is a person who follows a ton of people. They have zero followers, and all they do is reach their kind of right-wing political groups, and friends have other accounts that are doing the same thing. They're clearly not a person. They're just somebody in a room who has 40 accounts who's just retweeting a bunch of political propaganda.
Right, and that's their job.
So once you come, that's their job, right? And more power to them, I guess.
I know. Yeah.
I gotta make a buck. So, but I do think that, like, once you know how to recognize the signs of a fake person on the internet, it becomes really obvious, and you start to be able to, you know, block those people and, you know, not pay attention to them and find legitimate sources for your news. And so, like I said, I really hope that people become more educated about that, because it's not that hard, and it will really help people make informed decisions when they're voting in 2020. So, yeah, and in the meantime, let's make sure that our voting machines do have paper audit trails. That's the key phrase that you want to be looking for.
Yeah, I think anybody who objects to having a paper audit trail, in my mind, like, the first word association I get is guilty. You're guilty if you don't want a paper trail.
Why don't
like
you want that?
Exactly. What's your objection? Right. I'm so glad we talked about social media accountability, you know, because I think that there's really kind of this human nature behavior that says, I'm more interested in being right than I am with it being real or true or factual. And that's dangerous. I think that's really dangerous when people are more interested in being right, which to me translates to righteous pretty quick. And again, that behavior isn't exclusive to any political biases. It seems pretty, even across the board. But I had one other question. We're just about to wrap up. Zombies, love them or hate them? I don't know.
I mean, I really feel like it depends on the zombie. Like, is it is
okay?
It, what is zombie in the service of what? You know,
can zombies zombie be in the story, service like, of anything besides brains? Do they have?
I mean,
can they be work?
You know,
can you work with them?
I mean, maybe, like, there's movies like 28 Days Later that I think have a great view of zombies and kind of show how we are the zombies, even when we haven't been zombified, and, like, why that's a problem. And then I think there's stuff like The Walking Dead, where I feel like the zombies are used as an excuse to kind of reinvent sort of violent patriarchy and, depressing view of human nature, which I think is ultimately not very realistic. I think people are a little bit more complex than just kill or be killed. And so, yeah, I like some zombies, don't like other zombies. Brains, because, like, prion diseases are real.
That's true. That's true. What are you working on next? What's coming next from you?
My next book is coming out next summer. It's going to be another pop science book. It's about archaeology, and it's about four ancient abandoned cities and why they grew so big, and why these cities were so important in their cultures, and then why people decided to leave those cities, even though they were super fancy and cool. And so it's kind of looking at how cities grow and change over time. And it feels, since now we're living in a society where the majority of people on Earth live in cities, it feels like there's a lot of questions that we need to be asking. And as usual, I'm looking back at history to try to figure out where we're going. So it's been really fun. I visited a lot of archaeological sites and got pretty dirty and hot. So it was fun to report the book, and I can't wait for people to see it.
Last question. What music are you listening to right now? What are you reading?
I am listening a lot to Janelle Monáe, who is a fantastic singer and songwriter and very science fictional and upbeat in a way that I love. And I'm also listening a lot to a band called The Internet, which is kind of soothing, electronic, bouncy, fun music that's queer. And I am reading Valerie Valdez's novel Chilling Effect, which is a super fun space opera, great escapist story about an awesome Latina space captain who is literally hurting psychic space cats in her spaceship by accident. She somehow comes into possession of these space cats. But she's also trying to rescue her sister who's been kidnapped by a space cartel. And it's like a fun adventure, and it has romance, and it's just like, it's a great just escapist read if you need some like sort of like Firefly Cross the Star Wars. It's really good.
That sounds really fun. I love any space cats. Yes. Yes, the space cats.
Yeah, you can't go wrong.
You cannot go wrong. I'm talking with Annalee Newitz about her new book, The Future of Another Timeline. She'll be wrapping up her latest book tour tonight in the Clackamas Barnes & Noble, 7 p.m. It's at 12000 Southeast 82nd Avenue in Portland/Clackamas. And you can hop on down there tonight and grab a book and meet Annalee. And I think that would be a really delightful way to spend your Friday night. Annalee Newitz, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It was great to talk to you.
Also, I want to mention Catcher podcast. You can just get it on iTunes or whatever podcast tool you use. It's called Our Opinions Are Correct. And it's not just about science fiction. It really covers a lot of different topics, and it's delightful. And I've really been enjoying kind of catching up on all of those episodes. And I want to encourage, if you're looking for a new podcast, give it a try. And have a great reading tonight.
Thanks. Yeah, have a good day.
All right. Thank you so much, Annalee.
All right. Bye now.
And you're listening to The Digital Divide every second Friday of the month at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Rabia Yaman. And stay tuned for music with Moving On.
With golden chairs, this art to follow.
time is 12 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
I've been a rambler all my romp and roaring days. A railroad boy with nothing for to do.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Bill Staines is the featured artist for the upcoming October 11 concert. Bill Staines is a singer-songwriter whose career has spanned five decades, and his songs have been recorded by many well-known artists. That's Bill Staines in concert, Friday, October 11 at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Passport to Empowerment.